this week, we've been looking at this odd but interesting relationship some former Mormons have with psychedelics. Our producer, Benjamin Bombard, brought the story to us, how people who left the faith were looking to replace parts of it, or in some cases, heal from the demands of a religion that asks a lot of its members. And they found that healing and this sensation of transcendence in these trips that they would take with stuff like magic mushrooms and ayahuasca. Steve Urquhart is part of this community, I guess you could call it. In fact, he's one of its leaders, if there are any. There's no formal structure here. Urquhart was a Republican state lawmaker for years. Pretty conservative. He and his wife, Sarah, were raising their family in southern Utah. He was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints until he wasn't. They came to this period in his life when he says he was unraveling.
I had been in the legislature 16 years and lost myself in a lot of significant ways. One of those was I entirely lost my religious foundation, my spiritual foundation. I left Mormonism. I didn't believe it. And therefore, at the time, I thought I didn't believe anything. And so I tried to fill that hole with different things, alcohol, drugs, affairs that were damaging to everyone. All of this on a public stage, trying to keep it out of the public eye. There's just a tremendous amount of deceit in my life and hiding things that came from just a rawness in my soul. So one night, just took all the opioids I had, which were a lot, figuring this is it. I don't want to do this anymore. And then immediately when I did that, I mean, just immediately, I realized, oh, I don't want to die. You know, I did throw up and was starting to slip away at that point and just sunk into oblivion on the bathroom floor and not knowing if I was going to come back from that. And the next day I did. I woke up and got dressed and went to the Capitol and did my work and didn't tell anyone about it. And so Sarah was just saying, look, I know who you are. You have no idea who you are. What on earth is going on? And so the conversation was, okay, let's get you healthy, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do. And we had some friends who had tried ayahuasca, and they were talking about the healing that they were experiencing through psychedelics. And to my surprise, Sarah was interested. And we ended up in Amsterdam, and I just did some research on the internet, looked at social media, and sent a message to someone saying, hey, it looks like you work with ayahuasca. My wife and I would like to try that. And it just ended up being a terrific experience. I started seeing some lights. Red and brown lights. And then I see shapes that people call sacred geometry, a lot of fractals. With ayahuasca, they say that it's a feminine medicine and it has the spirit of the madre, they say, the mother or the grandmother. So I found myself sitting with the madre. Very maternal, very gentle. And as I look back on it, it's kind of like a parent would have been watching a toddler learn to walk. So So I had this landscape scene, and the Madre was part of it. And then I started transforming this scene according to the different painters, the different artists I could think of. Here's this scenery as if Monet painted it, as if Picasso painted it, as if Degas did. And so then, you know, the Madre just indicated to me, okay, this is how these artists would do it. How would you do it? What does it look like if Steve Urquhart creates this scene? You know, that's the kind of thing that I would have wilted before something like that. I don't know what, but I did. I created the scene in this new and really extraordinary way. And that kind of was a message to me that my life was not in a great situation at that point. The scene of my life, if you were to paint it, it wouldn't be very pretty. It was fraught. But it was the message to me that I can create. I can take my life and I can change it. But then the scene just started to dry out. Everything was burning up and just turning to dust, turning to desert. I think that part of it was I can create anything, and I also can destroy whatever I create. And the destruction that I was seeing in that scene was the toxicity that I still had inside of me. It was the trauma, it was the shortcomings, the things that I had to work through. And as long as they were part of me, as long as they manifest, then I wouldn't really be able to create anything beautiful that would be durable and lasting.
How did that change your life? What did this open up then for you in terms of perspective and possibilities?
I had never seen God in my life before that. I had never had an experience where I felt I was in the presence of God. I joined a dogmatic religion when I was 10 years old, and so I had the answer key. And I think that that led to spiritual stagnation. And so I think that I felt a lot of pressure to be a certain way, act a certain way, rather than to just be. And so I left that very first psychedelic experience just thinking that there is something magical and amazing and powerful out there, and I want to find it. That was the beginning of a love story with me and psychedelics, and it was a very important chapter in a much bigger and more important love story, which is my relationship with Sarah. It's really fun for us to find each other at all steps along the journey.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Steve Urquhart is joining us for the hour. His story is interesting, and like most of the former Mormons Benjamin Bombard has been talking to over the last few months, Urquhart was once fully in as a Latter-day Saint. He was devout. He relied on what they called the Spirit. This feeling of warmth, people in the church say, is like the presence of God. And it's this sensation that a lot of people who left the church say they have replaced with psychedelics. Only Urquhart has taken this one step further. He started his own church. He calls it the Divine Assembly. And the sacrament for this church, I guess you could say the core ritual in the practice, is psychedelics, magic mushrooms mostly. These days, Urquhart lives in Salt Lake City. He joined us a few weeks ago to talk.
I found Mormonism when I was just about 10 years old. You know, my Sunday morning ritual was watching Houston wrestling on
one of those, what do you call those off channels? The UHF?
UHF channels, yes.
Yeah, it was awesome. And so I knew all the characters of Houston wrestling. And we would occasionally go, I mean, my poor grandpa, he was very religious and he wanted us to go to Methodist church with him, but that was just very boring compared to Houston wrestling. And so it was kind of a mudded family. You know, a brother committed suicide when I was 6 years old. My parents hated each other before that and never really talked to each other after that. And we had some friends who were Mormons, started going to church with them, and loved it.
Why? Why did you love it? It gave you a sense of structure, gave you a sense of order in a world that wasn't terribly structured, it sounds like.
I liked the sense of belonging. These were really neat kids that were going. I really enjoyed them and then really enjoyed. I didn't have a lot of adult interaction in my life, a lot of adult involvement. And these were really good adults who, you know, at the time I didn't realize why it resonated, but they cared about me. They were concerned and they were looking to help me, and that really felt good.
And what did your experience with Mormonism in those early days tell you about what an experience with God was supposed to be like? Like, what was your image of God, and what did you expect to hear from God or experience God in some way?
God was this remote being that could just really be brutal in a second, you know, just swing and be quite cruel and mean. But at the same time, you know, you always knew that reality was there. But at the same time, all the teachings are that God is the best and is all loving and is wonderful. And you need to completely conform to his desires and his whims, his doctrine, his everything. And so I bought it fully, just thinking, okay, well, I want that. If this is the superlative, if this is the best, and this is what someone is telling me is ultimate happiness, I want that. And so I tried really hard, did my best to conform, to follow.
Mission for the church, temple marriage, you were all in. Sounds
all in. But here's part of, I think, what makes me is I never could fit into that cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. And so even joining, you know, my brother, who I loved, and that was one of the two sanctuaries of my life, was his room, where it was him, his hippie friends, great music, and pot 24/7. You know, that was stripped away from me. And the doctrine, which I right away, I'm like, okay, what about him? Well, he's going to hell, right? Because anyone who kills themselves, that's a violation against life, blah, blah, blah. He's going to hell. Okay, well, what about my family? Well, you know, your dad's not part of the church, and so you're not part of this eternal celestial marriage thing. So, yeah, you're not going to have your family. And so right away I'm like, okay, but this is true. This is awesome, right? I mean, this is the best thing there is, and we don't quite fit in. And then my whole life, yeah, and I think, probably most people like this. Well, I never quite fit in. I mean, there are things where I'm like, this doesn't feel right, but that's just me, right? I mean, this is the plan, so there must be something wrong with me. So there was something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my family, but this is the real, true, wonderful thing.
Give us a sense of your worldview then, maybe compared to now. And we'll talk about the worldview now, but I guess your political ideology, which is interesting to me. You were a fairly conservative Republican Utah legislator from a very Republican conservative place.
Well, worldview, I'm going to take you back to fifth grade. I've learned this is a formative time in my life, and it happens to be, and we can talk about this later, that this happens to be right after I joined Mormonism. I mean, I joined it in fourth grade and I got the answer key, right? I mean, in that paradigm, I have the answer to everything. Whatever the problem is, I have the answer. And so fifth grade, I would stand on this corner, Ridgecrest and Ridgeview. I was a crossing guard, so I had my sash, my badge, my cane pole with the orange sign that said stop. And I picked this corner because it was the least trafficked way to the elementary school. And I would just sit there and cry. And I'd scan Ridgecrest and Ridgeview, who's coming. If anyone's coming, I'd dry my tears, get them across the street. Then I'd just sit there and cry. I was so alone and scared. And so I think that was my world view. Probably, you know, there's my own unique mental baggage, anxiety or depression, whatever. But I was just, my worldview was alone and scared. And so I think I carried that forward until recently. And so, of course, I'm Republican, right? I mean, Republican is kind of, here is the way it is. It is this, it isn't that. And so I think I gravitated toward a church, toward a party that really has some absolute rights and wrongs.
So it sounds like Mormonism, by giving you structure, but also giving you answers, limited your growth. It like impeded your sense of progress, which is ironic when Mormonism is supposed to be all about progress, right? So you, I guess it seems like you were wondering what would it have meant if you didn't have the answers at that age as a Mormon.
Yeah.
Because you would have kept searching for all those big, large existential questions, I guess.
Yeah. I don't think I was a particularly screwed up kid. I mean, you know, I have friends, and I know that it isn't a comparative sort of thing, but I have friends who, they really had childhood trauma. They really had difficulties, but they kind of figured things out and they coped a lot better as an adult than I did. I mean, you know, there was a part when I just completely fell apart on a very public stage, and I was trying to hide that from the public and from the press, and I didn't want to become the subject of a lot of headlines. But I think my progression was completely arrested when I was given that answer key.
You also say that being Mormon, being in a structured religious institution, kept you from, this is how you explained it to us, loving fully, loving, as you've put it, fiercely. What do you mean?
If someone had told me, Steve, you only love partially, you don't even know how to love wholly and fiercely, I would have been offended. I would have said, you have no idea my relationship with Sarah, with our kids. I love them completely. And I just didn't. And that has to do, I think the capacity to love is directly proportional to our self-worth and the love we have for ourselves. And I just didn't have much love for myself. I was very incomplete, I wish I had a different word. I don't really love this word, but I think I was very broken inside. And until I started to heal myself and really develop my core, I wasn't able to fully love.
Steve Urquhart. He's an attorney. He's also an adjunct professor in family and preventative medicine at the University of Utah School of Medicine, founder of the Divine Assembly. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Utah lawmakers and our governor seem to agree.
A high-quality education can change everything.
But, you know, money. I'm Sonia Hudson.
I'm Emily Means. And we're your hosts for KUER's politics podcast, 45 Days. This week, we're looking into the budget for K-12 students and why Utah ranks 51st in the nation in per-pupil spending.
Listen to the show at 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This week on the show, we've been exploring the story of former Latter-day Saints who have turned to psychedelics to fill the voids left in their lives. One of them is former conservative lawmaker Steve Urquhart, who left Mormonism after he felt his world unraveling. And it was a psychedelic experience, he says, that saved his life. Now he started a church that uses magic mushrooms as a sacrament. I know this is probably a longer story that has a longer arc to it, but at what point did you realize you needed to leave Mormonism?
I realized that when I saw how my daughter was being treated. My oldest daughter was born a unicorn, and she was just different. And it's tough to be different in Mormonism, especially different in St. George, small town Mormonism. Yeah. And so she was really being picked on, bullied by good Mormon kids. And I don't use that word lightly. I knew these kids. They were great. They were good individuals. They just saw something different in my daughter, and they targeted her. And, you know, I don't, as weird as this is, I don't have any antipathy to them. They were just kids. I think they were victim of a structure, of a paradigm where that's kind of what they were trained to do, is seek out the other and destroy. Now, lightly destroy, you know. And so I think that that's part of the thing, is there is just this need to conform. And people who don't conform, you know, they're ostracized, they're othered, they're persecuted. And it's just an impossibility for my oldest daughter to conform, seeing how she was brutalized by the culture. That really started to distance me from it. And then I started to, as I got into, you know, LGBTQ activism, I started to understand why she was being othered. She was scary. I mean, she was a threat to the doctrine, to the institution. And so I picked her. I picked individuals. I mean, I've always been drawn to vulnerable individuals, and always have felt this kind of, you know, watchman a tendency that I'm going to look out for people who are vulnerable, and, you know, realize that, well, hell, my own legislative experience, something I really valued and worked hard at, I wasn't doing anything for vulnerable people other than maybe making life tougher for them. And I started to think, man, this isn't who I am. I'm living someone else's vision for me, and I don't particularly like this vision. And then watching how my daughter was being treated, I just really checked out. And so, you know, tried to go through the motions, just thinking, okay, this provides mooring for my family, for my kids. I just don't want to yank this out from under them. And so this kind of went on for quite a while. And finally, Sarah, she said, "What, you got to tell me, what's the deal? Why?" I said, "Well, I just don't believe it anymore." And she said, "Okay, well, I don't either." And so that was kind of it.
Wow. So when you left, did you go searching for something to replace it, or did you just sort of sit with it for a while?
Yeah, drugs, alcohol, women, you know, yeah. not God. I figured I'd been there, done that. And, you know, I had a really undeveloped moral, ethical compass. I had checked boxes and racked up celestial Bitcoin. And when none of that applied, I didn't know who I was and what I stood for. And yeah, I went looking in some really fraught places.
At what point during all of this did psychedelics occur to you?
After I was out of the legislature. While I was in the legislature, I mean, the last especially 4 years, when I'm accomplishing some big things, that was the only functional aspect of my life. I mean, I was completely unraveling.
Well, explain, because you've talked about really falling apart in a very public way.
Yeah, well, it wasn't public. I was on a public stage, but on stage...
Inside, you're falling apart.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd say my last 2 or 3 years in the legislature, when I was accomplishing some big things, I probably was drunk and or stoned every single day. Had some really torrid affairs, and, you know, it was hiding from everyone, lying to everyone, including myself, and, you know, contemplating suicide, attempted once, and, you know, just didn't really, I mean, this goes back to the corner that I was standing on in fifth grade, where I just felt completely alone. And, you know, was just depressed every single day when my eyes would open and the sun was up. And, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And, you know, the one thing that was there was the legislature, which, you know, that's a bit of a fiction, right? I mean, that's not me. That's not my family. That's not, it's I'm out swinging a sword at other things. And I could do that. And that was a great distraction from the things that were going on in my heart and my head. And so I think that's part of the reason why I was getting so much done legislatively, is that was a great escape, an all-consuming escape. And arguably you could say that one at least was a healthy escape. And so while I'm doing that, I am going through a lot of personal evolution. I'm starting to, I mean, this is, I think, the processing that maybe a healthy teenager does, right? I'm starting to think, what do I stand for? What don't I stand for? And, you know, even the things that I'm really losing myself in, I'm like, God, this can't be it. But I didn't know where else to turn. And so Sarah got dragged into all of this, you know, unfortunately, and not like I ever went to her and said, hey, I'm having problems. We're having problems. You know, she would find out about stuff and sometimes just horrific ways. And, you know, Sarah's a classy, good, accomplished person. And just the muck that she was being dragged into was horrible. So, you know, we're just like, okay, we've got to get off this stage. We've got to get out of the legislature and deal with this. And we didn't know what that meant. And so we didn't know. She didn't know if that meant together, separate. But, you know, she knew that I was a really good father. I mean, I always was and still am. And so she's like, okay, to some degree, I have to get my kid's father healthy, or at least give him the chance to get healthy, then, you know, we'll figure out what we're doing. And at this point, I had some friends who were doing psychedelics. They were using ayahuasca, and they felt like they were on some great journeys of personal progress. And Sarah and I talked about it, and surprisingly, surprising to me, she was quite interested. And then left the legislature, and coinciding with the beginning of the legislative session, the first one I was going to miss, in case I was tempted to miss it, we were in Amsterdam. Just figuring, we've always loved Amsterdam. It's a great place for us to think, for us to be free and reason. And while we're there, I did a little Google foo, and we ended up in an ayahuasca session in someone's apartment. And I think that changed our lives.
Is it difficult to explain or describe in, you know, just conventional terms what one of these experiences is like? You know, it's like that idea, you have to be there. You had to have been there to have experienced it. Is it difficult to explain?
Yeah, absolutely. It's impossible to explain. Now, if someone has been in the experience, then they can appreciate it in a different way. I mean, one of the big experiences to me is I saw, and I, most of my things, I start out with my youngest daughter. And my youngest daughter, life comes at her pretty fast. And she has never said a negative word about anyone. She's 21 years old. And, you know, that's just how she approaches life. And so I saw her in one of these sessions, ceremony, and what I call this space, this mystical state of consciousness where the divine exists, I call it the Holy of Holies or the Sanctum Sanctorum. And so when I was in that space, and that doesn't happen every ceremony, but I think my first time to really enter that space, and that's a space beyond the colors and lights and shapes. It's more this all-consuming all-encompassing space.
Wait. I want to get a sense of this. So you talked about the colors. You talked about the burst of creativity, it being playful. But now you're moving into another realm of it, another sphere of it. Now it's something more profound, it sounds like.
Yeah, for me, it started out very playful and positive. And now moving into this space where I'm seeing things. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean seeing things about me, about my soul. I kept thinking, okay, what do I do with my super important life? How do I help the world? How do I bless the world with my tremendous talents and insight?
I'm a good lawmaker. I'm a good lawyer. I'm good at this stuff.
Yeah, I got mad skills. What can I do for the world? And I just didn't ever get any of that until pretty recently. What I would get every single time, and I think there's something about this, is I got glimpses into my soul and who I am, what I am, how I'm showing up and how I'm not showing up. And so in a lot of these, there's just this messy puddle of Steve in the middle of the floor where I'm just sobbing as I see things. And so on this one, I saw Sarah, my wife, and I saw our four kids. And I just saw them as the most glorious beings. I just never could imagine that anything was this glorious. And so seeing my youngest daughter, Lucy, seeing her first, you know, she's just looking at me and her glasses, I always tease her about this. It's like she smears Vaseline on them. She never cleans her glasses. So I always just grab her glasses from her and clean them off. And so her glasses were smeared. And, you know, she looked exactly like she is, but I could barely take it that she was so glorious and spectacular. Then I saw Sarah, I saw all of our kids. And I mean, I was just coming out of my skin. It was so amazing. And then kind of this thought of I'm not worthy of this. And, you know, it's interesting that worship comes from the word worthiness. And I mean, I was just hyperventilating. This was an experience that the only word I can come up with is rapture. I think we default to these religious words because they're the superlative words in our language. And
well, one of those words is divine, you know, like,
yeah.
And it does make me wonder, because you say that you basically are experiencing something like the divine. So is the divine in this context an experience? Is it it's not an outside figure. It's not a god or an external figure. This seems like it's something more, much more deeply internal than all of that.
Yeah. So for me, encountering the divine just means learning who I am and being present in the moment. Mm-hmm. And when I'm able to do that, then I just see in the people who are around me and the situations I'm in, that is more godlike than anything I ever knew beforehand. So in this first time entering the sanctum sanctorum, I see my wife and our kids, and I see them as I think they walk the earth. I think I saw them in the glory they possess as sentient, independent, autonomous, wonderful beings. And it was so overwhelming. And that changed how I treat them. I mean, I'd always done my best to be good to them. You know, even as I say that, I realize the things I'm describing, you know, what I was doing individually, that's not being very good to Sarah. But, you know, I was trying as I could get through the day and be good to them. But seeing them as I think they truly are, it raised the standard. And that brought me low, as I'm just seeing all the ways that I have failed them and continue to fail them. But where I've been lucky is while I'm in that space, in the sanctum sanctorum, brought low to see my failings, I then realize, okay, I have time. I can do better. And so I leave just really committed and inspired to do better. And having seen it, I actually do better after I leave that space every time.
So having had these experiences, what did that tell you about the transcend, no, about God? Like, what is God? Are you God? Or like, are we God? Is God something inside where we've always thought of it as a, you know, depending on your sort of faith tradition or your ideas, as something else, as another being somewhere else, as an energy somewhere else? Does it, have those experiences given you a sense of God in a different way?
Yeah. I was taught that we were made in God's image, and that's not the case. God was made in our image, and God is a concept we throw out there of what is the superlative being. And I now, anytime I'm in traffic or in any situation where formerly I would have got impatient, I just murmur to myself, 8 billion gods. And so I just think that everyone is a god, and everyone I encounter is a god. And I realize that I am a god. I have the power to create and to destroy. I have the power to love and to hate. And, you know, we have all of these capabilities. And the more we are present, the more we are available and whole to serve others, the more we can act as God and build the divine around us.
Steve Urquhart, he's an attorney and an adjunct professor in family and preventative medicine at the University of Utah School of Medicine, also founder of the Divine Assembly. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with former state lawmaker Steve Urquhart. He's part of this loose community of former Mormons who take magic mushrooms and other psychedelics. They say they found healing from their past lives and discovered a new sense of spirituality. When does the idea of the Divine Assembly come to you? Like, I guess the way I want to ask this is, why couldn't you just leave well enough alone, just have these experiences? Why did you decide you wanted to create, I don't even know if religion's the right word, but
yeah,
the Divine Assembly?
No, that's a perfect question. It's a question that I, when I first got the inkling, when I first got the idea, that's a question that I asked myself. And then that's a question that Sarah asked me. And my closest friends, they're like, oh, no, stop. We just left one goofy ass religion. We don't need a religion. And there is truth to that, that we can do this stuff on our own. But you look at Salt Lake City, you look at Utah. Well, who really is free to have these experiences? Who is free to commune with the divine in the sanctum sanctorum? It's mostly affluent white people. And anything that is illegal and underground, there's going to be some danger involved in that. Danger, physical danger, health danger. There's going to be danger of prosecution. And it's easier to navigate those things when you're not really that concerned about the law, when you have some financial privilege. And so, you know, I am a good lawyer, and I became pretty expert on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, on the First Amendment. And interestingly, in our Utah Constitution, people don't know this, it guarantees a perfect tolerance of religious sentiment. I mean, those are powerful words, right? Perfect tolerance of religious sentiment. Well, I realized that these experiences I were having, they are every bit as profound as any religious experience that anyone walking this earth has ever had. Now, while I say that, I'm quick to say, and anyone can have these type of noetic, powerful experiences where they commune with the divine. They have an authoritative vision that directs them. So I realized, okay, this is religion. If people are to have protection, to worship in this way, that I think is a powerful way to worship, to where they can heal, where they can go down this pathway of improvement that I think I'm just racing down at this point, they need the protections of religion. And so I make no bones that the divine assembly, a huge part of it is to gain religious protection for this sacrament and this form of worship.
You don't want it to be this way, but you realize you've got to do some paperwork here. It's just the way it is.
That's the way the world works. And yeah. Every single religion that has put in the paperwork, they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
They're availing themselves of the laws to protect their form of worship. And so, this isn't an excuse to just use drugs. This is the way to legally go about setting up a platform, a format in which we can worship, in which we can sincerely commune with the divine and receive direct guidance.
How does it work? Is there a ceremony to it? Is there some kind of formal presentation or preparation? How does it work if you're part of the divine assembly?
So we are very adamant about safety, because the reason psychedelics work is you get in this vulnerable state to where you're subject to suggestion, you're subject to introspection, you're subject to change. Now, that can be a place of tremendous predation, moral, religious, spiritual, sexual. And so that stuff happens. And so we really try to be upfront about this is a safe, interconnected community. So we won't tolerate anything that isn't safe. That's part of religious protection, is we're legal to do this stuff. So don't worry about calling the police. Don't worry about involving expertise to handle situations that aren't ideal.
And what are you taking? I know that seems like a clumsy question, but what exactly are you using? What are you taking? What gets you into these psychedelic experiences?
Yeah, so our sacrament is psilocybin mushrooms, magic mushrooms.
Got it.
So what I try to do going into a ceremony is I try to do asset-based thinking, which is, okay, what are, rather than deficit-based of what are the flaws, what are the holes that need to be filled, I'm thinking, okay, what are the good things that are out there? What are the pieces of a good puzzle? And so I try to go in a positive way. I used to go in thinking, okay, I would like insight on this or that. And I don't do that anymore because I never get it. I learned this at the beginning. Everything I was getting at first was just, okay, Steve, here's where you're not showing up. Here's where you're not present. Here's what you can work on. So I just kind of go in, okay, what does the sacrament have to show me? And then it's very important, set and setting. You know, anyone who does psychedelics, whether it's religious, whether it's any other way, set and setting. You need to be in a good frame of mind. You need to be with the right people. You need to be safe. You need to be secure. And so I think that the things that can happen in ceremony can be and should be very different. I mean, I've been in just some tremendous dance parties that look extremely frivolous and silly, but it is worship. And that's where, even if not directly in the ceremony, some of the biggest spiritual downloads have come after I've just been so, this might be like the whirling dervishes, you know, where after I've been so elevated and animated, so much energy, then in that space comes a lot of profound insights. But then other ceremonies, it's just all on my mat. Where I'm on my mat, other people on their mat,
and we agree beforehand, we're not going to communicate with each other. We're not going to interact, because whatever you have going on your mat, that's your work. And to the extent I'm paying attention to that, talking with you, then that's an excuse for me not to do work on my mat. And so,
but how is that a communal experience? If you're all having these personal distinctive experiences, that doesn't seem like a communal enterprise that a lot of people think of when they think of faith. We're gathering together to share this common experience. It seems like you have to be more creative about that under these circumstances.
Well, one commonality I'll share with, you know, any of the Mormon audience that's listening, this is how the temple ceremony is, right? The temple ceremony, you're completely alone, and you're not interacting with the person to your left or to your right. You're not interacting with your spouse who's across the room. It's an individual thing that you're going with together. And so that's the way some of these ceremonies are, is, you know, we start. And we do have some commonalities where we are interacting at the beginning and sharing intentions or what we're bringing into the ceremony, what we hope to get out of it. We'll take the sacrament. We'll do some group meditation or some sort of exercises. Then we do have this alone time on the mat. But then afterwards, we'll come together, we'll sit in a circle, and we'll start the integration process to talk about, okay, what was my journey? What was your journey? Wow, how might these relate? There really is some magic that comes out of this group. Some of the best friends I have in life I've met in ceremony, and we really check in on each other. How are you doing? What's thinking about you? And this incredible bond can develop.
Steve, I wanted to finally come back to an image you mentioned earlier, and that is of this child, you, on a corner, alone, scared. And it goes back to an experience that you had that you've talked about, a psychedelic experience, where you went back to visit your younger self.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to take me through that, because it sounds like this kind of inner voice that you experienced was kinder, more understanding than the inner voice you had been experiencing before.
Standing on this corner has always just been prominent in my mind. So I was in a ceremony and I got the thought, I'm like, I'm going to go visit this kid. So I went back and just gave him some love and just said, man, you have no idea how good it turns out. You have people in your life who love you. You just have a wife who, God knows why, she just loves you so much and sticks with you. You have these wonderful kids. And it was neat. I visited him a second time, and I wanted to do the same thing. And so he said, hey, thanks. I appreciate this. You misunderstand me. He said, I am here. And I'm whole. I made it. We know that. I'm worried about you. Can I send you some love? I was in a ceremony. And at the beginning of this ceremony, when I'm really starting to enter this space, and man, oh man, did I enter the divine? Did I enter the holy of holies, the sanctum sanctorum in this one? As I'm just starting to enter, kind of standing guard on it, was this giant Polynesian warrior. I mean, just the most glorious being I'd ever seen. And so he saw me, and he just, the reverence he had for me, it was profound. That was my soul I was looking at, that this 10-year-old, 80-pound, scared kid, that was the soul that got me through. Seeing that that really was the strength and size of my soul to get me off that corner, that completely changed my view of myself and my inner voice. And I love my soul. I love who I am. And I speak to myself so positively. Now, occasionally, if I slip and do something that isn't perfect, then that old voice, if I say, God, what a dumb
which that's my, has always been my term of endearment to myself, is dumb. Then I'll say, no, I'm not a dumb. I'm a good person trying my best, and I'm making a lot of improvement. And this one didn't go exactly like I wanted it to, but here's what I'm going to do to make it better. And so, you know, forget how I got there. If someone wants to be dismissive of the power of psychedelics and what I call sacrament, forget how I got there. That's a wonderful place to be. And from that has come future steps, future leaps toward healing, toward connecting with others, to being more present, and to being a better husband, father, and person.
Steve Urquhart, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Doug.
Steve Urquhart, he's an attorney and founder of The Divine Assembly. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.